the life of the light company, the gas company, you know, and the life of the neighborhood in general. You know, I cannot tell you how much I owe you. I cannot tell you that I would never be able to repay you, you know, and I have a great deal of gratitude for this program, and I thank you, you know. So if you didn't hear anything, you heard that, you know. I was born in a country called Guyana, and my parents migrated here when I was 8 years old. But before we migrated here, I think I was displaying signs of alcoholism way before, you know, I can actually own that alcoholic mindset. You know, I remember I had my first drink when I was 6 years old, and it was the most exhilarating feeling that I've ever had. You know, in the West Indies, alcohol is kind of ingrained. Did you see what I just did? Kind of ingrained in the culture, you know. And rum was very, very big, you know. Oh, some people are catching up. Come on now, keep up. So, you know, when I say that, I mean that there is a culture in the West Indies of producing alcohol, you know, whether it's grain alcohol or rum. It was a big deal. My dad loves alcohol, still does to this day. You know, I remember in an effort, I think, to kind of get closer to my dad, my parents would have these little social gatherings, and, you know, my aunts and uncles would come over, and, you know, my little cousins and so forth, and, you know, the men would go to the kitchen and the women would be in the living room or vice versa. But in any case, I would always go wherever the men went. Wherever my dad went, I wanted to be. And, you know, he and his brothers or his friends would be sitting around the table. In general, they'd just be sitting there talking and drinking. You know, once in a while there'd be dominoes or cards on the table, but primarily rum was the guest, you know, the star. And I would remember them having booze in their glass, and I'd kind of sidle up to my dad, and I'd pick up his glass, and he'd tap me on the hand, leave that alone, you know? And then I'd go over to my uncle and try to sidle up to him, and then, leave that alone, get out of here, you know? And then I'd come back to dad, and he's like, okay, take one sip, but don't let your mother know. And I'd take a little sip, and then I'd go to my uncle and take a little sip. And, you know, after some time, I'm feeling something, some warmth, you know, something light, you know. And, you know, I distinctly remember spinning and trying to make myself even dizzier and spinning on the floor, and they'd be laughing, ah, look at that little guy. And, you know, I would be, you know, the center of attention. And, you know, my dad would be laughing at something that I was doing, you know. I remember that happening one time, and I spun myself into vomiting, you know. Yeah, but that happens, you know. But it was just one of many hundreds of times that I vomited after that, you know. But that was the beginning of this mindset that, well, this is just part of what I'm doing, you know. I drink to the point where I'm so dizzy I had to go lay down, and they put me to bed and I'd sleep all night. You know, and I remember my dad kind of taking a little pride in saying that, you know, that I could take a little rum. You know, yeah, that's my son, you know, that kind of thing. And it felt like a rite of passage, you know, even for a six-year-old, you know. I remember that my dad always would come home and he'd go straight to the liquor cabinet and, you know, pour himself a shot. And, you know, my mom would say something to him and he'd be, well, I'm just taking the edge off, you know, just, you know, getting unwound, you know. And, you know, it didn't appear to me as being obvious then, but I was receiving information at that time, you know. And what I now know is that there was that rites of passage thing was really something that my dad kind of gave me. He didn't give me the disease, but he gave me this feeling that, you know, to be a man, you got to be able to take it to the head and not cough, You know, and then as I grew, it became, you got to be able to drink and drive without any problems. You know what I mean? Because my dad took great pride in being able to drink and drive. And we now know that that's just not the way to approach a vehicle. But back then, you know, it was a badge, you know, and I wanted that badge, you know, and I earned it. You know, fast forward just a little bit, my Guyana became a little disturbed after the British left. We received our independence, I think, in 1968 or something like that. And after that occurred, it seemed that Fidel Castro was trying to kind of enter into Guyana and make it socialist. And there was a faction that was in agreement with that, and then there were some that were not. And, you know, there was a lot of turmoil, and people were disappearing, and people were being found dead and shot. And my dad and his brothers were all involved in government in some way, manner, or form. My grandfather was the fire chief, and then he became the police chief. And my uncles were all involved in some way. So my granddad decided to get his boys out of the country, and it was under the guise of sending them to London, because they were supposed to go to London to further their education and then come back to Guyana and use the education there. But instead, everyone came to America. Everyone went to different places, and my dad went to New York. So one night, I went to bed. My dad was there, put me to bed, and I woke up and he wasn't. He had left. My dad had this huge record collection, and in the very first record was Harry Belafonte, you know, and Harry Belafonte's album had his whole face on the album cover, and for some reason, I don't know if it was because I missed him or I was sad or whatever, but I saw my dad when I looked at that album cover. And for 3 years, Harry Belafonte was my dad. So, you know, I'm kind of like a celebrity. Yeah. So anyone come in to the house, and I would say, that's my daddy, you know, and my mom would just, you know, go along with it. I guess she recognized that this was somebody, something that I was feeling more so than something that I was, you know, building. But what the reason I mention that is because I think the first time I really felt emotionally connected to my dad was when we followed him to New York. And all the while that I was still in Guyana, that picture of Harry Belafonte was who I identified as my dad. And we took a flight from Guyana to Trinidad and Tobago. And we landed in Trinidad and Tobago, and we spent the night there. And I remember my parents, my mom, my sisters were in the hotel room. And I don't know why it is, but they went to sleep and I couldn't. And I found my way downstairs to the lounge. And the same thing that I used to do with my dad and his uncles, I ended up doing that night with perfect strangers, just sidling up to their drinks and taking sips. And I remember when my mom found me the following morning, and I think someone from the hotel brought her down. And I was asleep in the lounge on the floor, and she whooped my ass. You know, she was worried to death. You know, she must have woken and found me missing. And can you imagine just finding your 8-year-old, you know, in a drinking lounge in a hotel? So I remember that ass kicking. I remember how it stung, and I remember the words she said as she, you know, my mom used to talk to you while she was whooping you. You know, she'd be like, "Don't you ever," you know. And, you know, and I'm doing the run around. got me by that 1 hour. It's like, you ain't going nowhere. So, but I received that. You know, I got that. And what I also remember is when our plane landed at JFK. We had just left Trinidad and Tobago. And I remember having a linen shirt and linen short pants with a wool jacket. And it was January 18th. And we landed at JFK Airport, and it was 12 degrees outside. And back in those days, the airplane didn't pull up to the terminal. It landed on the tarmac, and they pushed some stairs up to the door. And then they opened up the door, and you walk down the stairs, and then walk across the tarmac into the terminal. Now, all my life I've spent in tropical temperatures. You know, nothing below 70 degrees. And anything below 70 degrees was, ooh, that's cold. You know, when that door opened, this chill ran through the airport. You know, and it was like an entity. You know, I looked at my sister, she looked at me, and she's like, oh my God. And I was like, yeah, that feels really, really cool. And my mom is holding my sister's hand, my sister's holding my hand, and we're approaching, we're walking down the aisle in the airport, and I just remember this so vividly. And it's just getting colder and colder as you walk closer and closer to the door. And then we got to the door, and the wind just went straight through that linen. You know, it was like I was naked out there. And we walked down those stairs, and the wind was just going through us. And I found that there was tears coming down my eyes, and the tears were freezing to my face. And we made it across that tarmac, and we got into the terminal. And I remember looking for Harry Belafonte. And I couldn't find Harry Belafonte, but what I did find was my dad. And as soon as I saw him, I remembered him, you know. That was the first emotional connection I felt to my dad at that time. You know, he transformed from Harry Belafonte into, you know, Leland Abrams, you know. And I remember him picking me up, holding me. And I had not been hugged like that for the next 20 years. I say that because it was important to me. I say that because it was something that has meant something to me. Now, I know that being a father, it comes in different sizes, and I love my dad. And nothing, absolutely nothing that happened to me was his fault. But I know that I've connected to men in ways that kind of mirror the father-son relationships that I've seen around me, not the one that I had. I didn't feel content, I don't think, that was giving me what I needed. You know, and I found that we communicated better when we were drinking. You know, and as I grew, the communication got more and more intense. You know, it turned from being cool to being very volatile, telling me and telling him, you know, we're just going to go ahead and tell each other how we're feeling. And that's what we did, you know. And we hurt each other's feelings, and we hurt each other, you know, in emotional ways, I believe. And I think it makes sense to mention that, because having worked that first step coming in here, you know, I commit to you that each one of those steps, something about that relationship showed up, you know. And even in the third step, where I've developed this relationship with God that I don't understand but loves and understands me and is concerned about me, I didn't have an image that would work, you know. I didn't have an image that I could use. When that occurred, I think I had already been 3 years sober. And my son was born. And in that relationship, I saw God. And I say this to you for this reason only, because I am a visual interactor. You know, I'm visual and I'm tactile. I need to get my hands around things to completely understand. understand it. If I am going to understand it, that's the way. And the way that God works with me is in that way as well. He uses you to reach me. And, you know, when my son was born, I think he had just started to learn to walk. And we had an apartment over in Holcomb Bridge, and he was with me that day. And I said, come on, let's go for a walk. And I opened up the door, and he jetted outside. Ping! Gone. And I'm turned, and I'm locking the door, but I got my eye on him. And he's running up the breezeway, and I see him going full speed. And then he gets to the end of the breezeway, and he starts to slow down. And I'm looking at him, and I see that he sees a cat that's walking on this wooden fence, but it's coming closer to him. And he did not take his eye off that cat. I think that was the first time he's ever seen a cat. And as the cat got closer, he got scared. He didn't know what it was, and he got scared. And one thing I did know is that he knew I was back there somewhere, you know. And as I got closer to him and the cat got closer to him, I saw he stopped. And then the cat's still coming, and I saw he didn't take his eye off, but he put his hands up in the air like this. He just put one hand up, and I'm getting closer, and the cat is too. And the closer the cat got, he threw his second hand up in the air, you know. And in that moment, I recognized what he was saying to me. He was saying, I need you right now, you know. That first hand is saying, Daddy, I think I might need help, you know. But when he threw that second hand, it's like, come get me, pick me up, carry me, you know. And in that, I saw, you know, what my relationship with God really is. You know, that is the true essence of my relationship with God. It's like, I need you now, you know. And the closer I got, the higher his hands went. The closer the cat was, the higher his anxiety and his fear was, you know. And when I picked him up, I could feel him clinging to me, you know. And I can tell you, in that moment, I did not and have not felt any closer than that to my son, you know. Because that cling, that squeeze, that hug still resonates with me today, even as when we talk. You know, I still see him as that kid who clung to me when in need, you know, and I believe that my higher power is like that with me now, you know, because I need him. You know, I open this up by saying, hey, y'all, my name is Troy, I'm an alcoholic, please pray for me, you know, and please know that I'm praying for you as well, because as an alcoholic and an addict, I need prayer, you know. I believe that that's one of the sharpest tools in my toolbox. That's one of the sharpest gifts that I've been granted in this program, is the ability to hit my knees and pray for you, you know. And in doing that, I'm giving you all I got, you know. And for me, you know, that was a solid idea, and it burned the concept into my mind that you know, the God I have is the God of love, you know, the God of love. And the things that have happened in my life, good or bad, you know, are presented to me for a reason. And I'm here to receive that information and then pass it on to somebody else. Now, that too is the charge of us here at Alcoholics Anonymous, those of us who've been around, you know, and we've received some stuff, you know, through the 12 steps and through this book, we've received some stuff. And it's incumbent upon us to give it away, to give it back. If you don't, it will atrophy, and inevitably, what I've seen, my experience is that you go back out. The power of this program is that it is portable. You can take it anywhere you go, you know. And if you so desire, you can sit with a man and have this interaction that would change that man's life and change you, you know. And there's no wrong way. And, you know, I hear it sometimes in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's no wrong way to come to God. And that's what this is about. This is about making ways, removing the obstacles, and getting a straight path to the God of your understanding. You know? So, you know, through my teens, I developed a taste for not just alcohol, but for drugs as well. And that taste grew, and until it too became unmanageable. You know, I would say to you that I had ideas that was going to change the development of this addiction. You know, I decided at 17 that I was going to get my parents to sign me into the Air Force, and that was going to be the thing that changed me. I don't know if y'all know, but there's more drugs in the Air Force than there are in the streets. I didn't know that at that time, and I found out very quickly, you know. I flew out to Lackland Air Force Base to do my basic training, and they said, no alcohol. What do you mean, no alcohol? They said, no drinking, you know. And I had to find a way to drink, and I connected with one of the people who had been there long before, and they gave me 2 bottles of beer, and I put it in the dumpster. Now, Lackland, Texas is pretty warm. And I put it in the dumpster early that morning because I had a detail to clean up the area. And then I was able, after lunch, to go back to the dumpster. But instead of standing around the dumpster, I climbed in the dumpster, closed the dumpster, and drank that hot beer. I passed out. They found me, and that, you know, that didn't help my development in the military. But it was just an indicator that, you know, there was something going on in this alcoholic brain. You know, I did my time there, and you know, drugs were just rampant. And I don't know if it's that way now. I went in 1979, so it may not be that way now. I hope it's not, you know. But by the time I got back to New York, I was a full-blown dope fiend. And it's not important. It's really not important, you know, what it is that what it is that you're taking to alter your state of mind. It's not important, you know. The mere fact that need existed for me to change how I'm feeling is really what, you know, I focus on today. You know, that I have to alter the way I was thinking and feeling. You know. Anyone of us can tell you that we surround ourselves with like-minded individuals. While I'm using, and even in my sobriety, well, while I'm using, I surrounded myself with like-minded individuals, and I found that you know, there were people who were worse than me. So I used that as a measuring stick that, hey, I'm not doing so bad. You know, I got a job. You know, I have a car. That guy doesn't, you know, but I'm still hanging out with that guy. And after a while, that guy didn't want to hang out with me. But I got a job, and I got a car, you know, but he didn't like the way that I was using. So I had to go to that another guy. Let's go down a little bit lower. And that guy got tired of hanging out with me. I was that guy that always would be willing to go get it. Sure, you know. Give me your money. I'll go get it. I'll be right back. You know, there's some people in New York waiting for me to come back today. You know, and it's been a minute. You know, I say that to say this, that my alcohol and drug addiction made my word worth nothing. You know, so if I said something to you, you know, believe it or not, I don't care, but you know, more than likely it was dishonest. You know, a lot of what we talk about is honesty, and a lot of what I heard when I first came in was cash register, not honesty. Not the kind of honesty that you would actually, you know, indulge in with self. You know, it's the kind of stuff that you can count on a calculator. Yeah, I could do that, you know. But what about the dishonest relationships that you entered into? I entered into quite a bit, you know, and people were hurt because of it. One of which was my marriage. You know, I found a wonderful woman. She was awesome. She is awesome, you know. Her dad came back from Vietnam, a heroin addict. So, you know, yeah, crackhead ain't that bad. That's just my way of measuring it. And I married that woman, and you know, we bought a house out of Long Island, and as soon as we pulled up with the moving truck, there was a guy 2 doors down, opened up the door. Hey, you guys need any help? And it was just she and I and a truck full of stuff. So I said, yeah. You know, so he's like, okay, be right there. He went, got on some sweats and the sneakers, and came outside. And he introduced himself to the two of us. And just add alcohol and instant best friends. You know? Instant best friends. And then after the alcohol was added, he's like, hey, you want to go get some blow? I was like, you're that guy, you know? How lucky am I? You know, that's what I'm thinking. I got that guy just two doors down, you know? And of course, you know, that relationship went sideways. You know, he loved guns, I love guns, you know? We had a bromance, you know? And, you know, he'd come by during the day and we'd go out in the backyard, shoot up a tree and get wasted. Yeah, and that year was really tumultuous. My cousin got out of jail. One of my, you know, I loved him to death, and he came out to Long Island. He lives in Brooklyn. Came out to Long Island. He's like, you know, I'm having a hard time finding a job, and so I connected him with my man, two doors down, you know, and they got off on an enterprise, and He started, you know, doing some street pharmaceutical work, and you know, and he was attempting to grow that career. And I remember one weekend, my cousin called me up and he's like, "Hey, let's go to Atlantic City. You know, I got a bunch of cash, and we can get some girls and you know, party on." So I went into Flatbush. I picked him up, and on our way over the bridge, he was like, pull over, let's go get some supplies, you know. And, of course, supplies is alcohol and drugs. And on Flatbush Avenue, the cars are parked on both ends. So, you know, you kind of have to double park. And he double parked and jumped out of the car and went into the store and said, I'll be right back. And I'm sitting in the car, and I could hear another car pull up the music. And I turned around, and it was this black Acura, and these guys jump out of the Acura, run into the store, and they come running out, and they jump into the Acura and took off. And music in the car was playing, so I couldn't really hear that well, but I just felt something was wrong. And that was October 12th. And I went in the store, and my cousin was laying on the floor, bleeding from his ear. And I slid right up onto him, and the guy behind the bulletproof glass was on the phone. He's with 911, and my cousin was looking at me, and he was alive for a little while. And then the EMT came, and then the police came. And then he went. That was October. And then November came. I was with my in-laws. I was at my in-law's house. My mother-in-law was there, and my sister-in-law, and my wife. And I was cooking dinner, and they're in the living room watching Jeopardy. The phone rings. So I picked up the phone in the kitchen. Hello. And a voice says, yes, hello, this is New York City Fire Department. This is the family of Mr. Morgan. And I said yes. And at that time, I was his son-in-law. And I said, yeah, this is his son. And the guy goes, well, I regret to inform you. And I said, hold on. That's never good. You know, when they start a sentence like that. And I put the phone on my chest, I took a couple of deep breaths, I looked in the living room, and I said, what is it? And he says, I regret to inform you that we found Mr. Morgan. He had overdosed on heroin, they found him in Brooklyn, and they were calling to have someone come and identify his body. So, hung up the phone, I got all the information, and I go in the living room, they're all giggling and having fun with Vanna. I said, hey, y'all, I got some news. And they were like, get out of the way, because I was standing in front of the TV. And And they're like, get out of the way, get out of the way. It's like, no, no. I turned off the television and said, they found Dennis and he's dead. And they just hit the floor. And we had to go identify his body that night. And that was November. So December, my sister called me and said, you know, Troy, you need a cleansing. You know, you need to cleanse your life. There's been so much tumultuous stuff happening. You should have something. So we had a New Year's Eve party and invited all our friends and family, and everyone came over and everybody brought a bottle and some people brought some other stuff, you know. And all the old folks were like in the living room, and then you go up a set of stairs and there's the kitchen, and then another set of stairs for the bedroom. And the ball dropped in Times Square, and everyone was celebrating. It was supposed to be, what did they call it back then? Damn it, Y2K. Y2K, y'all remember Y2K?
Yeah.
Everything was supposed to stop. The planes were supposed to fly and fall out of the air, and the trains were supposed to, none of that happened, but we had candles all over the house, and we were playing oldies music, and it was really a nice vibe going, you know, and we were getting drunk. And my phone rings, and it's my friend, two doors down. Yo, what's up, what you doing? Just celebrating with the family. You're more than welcome to come on over. And he's like, I'm at the front door. I said, all right. Came down the stairs. I opened the door. And I looked at him. And I can tell you, I could not see the whites of his eyes. And I don't know if that's a sign of my condition or a sign of the condition. But I said, come on in. Yeah, and I invited that into my home. Closed the door, and he was walking through the living room, and I introduced him to my in-laws and my family, brought him upstairs where the young folks were, and set him up with some food and something to drink. And I had a plate already fixed, and I was eating it before he knocked on the door, so I grabbed the plate, and I sat down on the stairs going up to the bedroom, and I'm eating, and then next thing you know, he's standing right in front of me. And he lifted his shirt up and he showed me this nickel plated 357. And he's like, let's go out back and shoot some shots and, you know, celebrate the new year. And I was like, oh, dude, I got my whole family here, you know, it's not really the best time. And he was like, come on, man, let's celebrate the new year. And I was like, no, I don't think that's a good idea, man. Just go sit down, finish eating. And matter of fact, man, I don't really feel good with that. And I took it out of his belt. And I went upstairs and I had a little lockbox where I kept my two pistols, and I put his in there and locked it. Came back downstairs, picked up my plate, and he's bouncing back and forth off the walls. Come on, man, go get my bitch. Go get my bitch, man. Come on, man. And I was like, look, I'll get it, but you have to leave, you know, and I'll talk to you later. So I went back upstairs, opened up the box, I got his pistol out, and something told me I should just get the bullets out of there. But he just lived a couple of doors down. His car was right in front of his bullets everywhere. So I closed it, put the safety back on, came downstairs, called him over, put it right back in his belt, gave him a hug, wished him a happy new year. And I just watched him. He walked downstairs from the kitchen. He's walking through the living room. And as he's walking through the living room, my in-laws, my mother-in-law and her two sisters are acting like they're the Supremes. And they're singing into hairbrushes. And as he's walking past, he says, ladies, don't be concerned. You're going to hear a couple of shots. I'm just celebrating the new year. And they didn't pay him no attention. Good night. And he goes through the door. I'm just looking at him. And I'm sitting down on the stairs, but I'm staring at the door. And as he's going out, I can see him pulling the door and pulling out the pistol. And just as that's going on, my mother-in-law's sister, Valerie, is like, she's a big girl, and she's tired, and she plops down in the chair and says, oh, my Lord! And she sits down in the chair, and then I hear, pow! And then, pow again, the shade moves, and the bullet goes right through her head and splatters on the wall. And I didn't believe it, you know. I thought I imagined it, but it was real. It was happening, and I run down the stairs, and I could see her sliding down the chair, and I could see this blood stain. And by the time I got there, she had already hit the floor, but I caught her head, and my hand just went right up into her skull. The hole was so big, and everyone watched me run down, and now they see what's happening, and the whole house turned into pandemonium, you know. And I told my wife to get the kids upstairs and throw me down some towels, and she was just throwing down like hand towels, and I'd reach them, but it would go right up into her skull and just wouldn't be doing anything. And they called 911, and everyone is upstairs, and the EMT comes, and I remember the police pulling me off of her, and the blood just all over me, and I can remember her brains feeling like macaroni in my hand. And they pulled me off her, and the EMT guys are working on her, and she had these tears coming down her face, and it looked like she was just saying, "What the F? What happened?" You know, and I didn't have any answers. And some people took off after the guy, and I was just there, you know. And then after she passed, the EMT guy looked back at me, and he said, "There's nothing I can do." And I remember going up the stairs, and it was just the longest walk, you know. And I got up to the bedroom, and I opened up the door, and everybody was in there on their knees praying. Yeah. So when I ask for prayer today, I know that there's some solace, you know, that I owe, you know, a great deal of prayer amends, because I was not a praying man then. I didn't see the need, and today that's just not so. When I sat with another man and I told him my story, and the first time I did that, the first sponsor I had, I told him my story, and he kept saying, "Damn, damn, shit, damn," you know. And after I left that session, I went to someone who had some real time, and he said, "You need to find another sponsor." And I did, and I found another sponsor a week later, and I told him the same story, and he was like, "Yeah, that's bad stuff, man," but, you know, and he shared a little bit of his own story with me. You know, I felt like I wasn't alone, and I felt like I had a cohort and someone that would be willing to have me join his journey in sobriety. I didn't feel apart, and I didn't feel less than. I wasn't made to feel ashamed, you know. And he showed me the parts that I played in all of the things that occurred in my life. I share this with you because I don't know what stage of your recovery you're in. But if you're new in the program and you have some negative experiences, that's not the only experience that's available here. You know, we are all sick. You know, we're just not all sick at the same time. And if you've got some stuff that has happened to you while here, change. Make a change. It's all right. You've got permission right now to make a change. You know, this is something that you have to do with people who are concerned with your well-being. You're not made to be felt smaller than or less than. You know, you're one of us. You know, if you bring bullshit, yeah, you're going to get some reality checks. Be prepared for that. That's all right. It's okay for some people to tell me the truth right now. It's okay. You know, I can take it. And if I can't take it, I can accept it. You know, I've learned through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that there is power in the we. There's no power in a me, you know. And every day I have an opportunity to make a choice. I can choose that misery that I came out of and pick up again, or I can choose the mystery that lives in this book and in these rooms and make a change. I don't know what's going to happen with the mystery. I know exactly where the misery is going to take me. I know exactly how that comes and what happens there. The mystery continues to reveal more and more to me, more about me and about you and about this God that I don't understand. that I've got a chance one day at a time, that if I wake up and my arms and legs are working, my eyes are seeing, my ears are hearing, and my mouth can speak, I've got a shot. And that's what this program offers me, is a shot. And, you know, there was a time that I didn't even have that. I've got a choice today, you know, misery or mystery. There was a time that I didn't have that choice. You know, today I win. And sometimes it's ugly. It's an ugly win sometimes. But if I make it to my pillow and I didn't pick up a drink or a drug and I didn't hurt somebody's feelings or hurt myself, that's a win. And sometimes there's beauty in even the ugly win. This program has shown me that. I've learned that there's always something to learn. You know, that I don't have all the answers and I don't want them. I'm glad that he releases information to me like I'm a second grader. Thank you, Father. You know, and if you don't know how to pray, thank you, Father, is a good way to start. Yeah. I'm here by the grace of God, good people like you, and the program of alcoholics that works if you work it. I'd like to thank Jerry for having me out tonight. You know, again, if you need me, call me.